Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, January 25th, 2019. Sudan's street protests gains momentum in Khartoum.
Today, there were, again, a lot of demonstrations, people coming out, especially in Khartoum, the capital, and there are news that some places in Jazeera and in different parts of the country are coming out, demonstrating, chanting the same slogans.
And a new campaign benefits thousands of South Sudanese refugees in Uganda.
Sometimes refugees go to the health facilities and in return they are not given medicines. And for that reason, I felt that the health sector integrated response will strengthen.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. After Friday's prayers in Khartoum, thousands of Sudanese took to the streets again today to protest against President Bashir's administration and the skyrocketing cost of food. INBR talked to Omar Ismail, a senior advisor to the ENAF project, about the latest developments.
The protests continue, and some reports that I've seen yesterday from some news agencies that this process of yesterday had been the largest that they have ever seen in recorded history in Sudan. That in itself is a big statement, showing that more people are getting into this protest, and the bystanders of yesterday are joining the demonstration today. So it doesn't look like we are going to see this demonstrations stop or even get smaller in size than what we have seen yesterday. Today, there were, again, a lot of demonstrations, people coming out, especially in Khartoum, the capital, and there are news that some places in Jazeera and in different parts of the country are coming out, demonstrating, chanting the same slogans. They were also reports that I've seen at least two people were killed yesterday, and one person was killed today. So the demonstrations are going strong. The people are believing more and more, and the Association of Professionals that is calling for these demonstrations every other day. And I've seen some reports coming out of Khartoum, and I talked to some people in Khartoum. They are talking about maybe they are going to raise the bar a little bit, and they might start calling for demonstrations every single day. So the confrontation with this government is going on, and it's reaching levels that we have not seen before. The violence is still continuing in many places. The people that were killed, many were injured. The behavior of the government did not change. And definitely the energy of the demonstrations did not go down at all.
Have you seen anything like this before?
I've not seen anything like this before. I was a child in October of 1964, and I was a fresh graduate in 1985 when we demonstrated against Jaffa Nimeiri at the time. And the demonstrations of March, April of 1985 defeated Jaffa Nimeiri. But I have not seen this level of energy. I have not seen this level of the contribution of young people. The amazing thing is that young people are coming together. And also another observation is that most of these demonstrations in the past took place in Khartoum, led by students mainly from the University of Khartoum, and other places. And in 1985, the trade unions contributed a lot. The what was called the modern forces at the time were leading the demonstrations and the, later on the negotiations with the government that led to the army siding with the administrators, and Nimeiro was ousted. However, this time, the young people are there in hundreds of thousands. The courage of the Sudanese women is just amazing. The demonstrations came out, and the women beside the men, and if you listen to those people who are participating in these demonstrators, they will tell you the stories of heroism that is beyond belief. So the social media, which was non-existent at the time, my time, played a pivotal role.
You think that social media has played a role in this round of protest?
Without a doubt, the social media was very vital to this. People, for example, watching the website of the Association of Professionals, and that is where they post the next demonstrations and where they should go, and they even post maps where people should, keep on coming from different directions into the center of Khartoum, for example, when these are in Khartoum, and in other places, they are sending warnings. Some of these young people are in different streets telling people about roadblocks. They instantly tell the world when somebody is killed, so some people are injured. They try to avoid the areas where they get into traps by the security forces, because people sitting at home and in some of those high buildings, they can see the gathering of these trucks of the security, and they will immediately send warning to the demonstrators that on the street or the intersection of XY, they are some of these what they call detachers, which is the light Toyota trucks that the security forces use, and the demonstrators avoid these areas.
That's Omar Ismail, a senior advisor to the Enough Project, speaking from Addis Ababa with my colleague Ayendeng Bior. 8 years ago, as protests erupted across the Middle East and North Africa, thousands of Egyptians took to the streets. They called for democratic change in a country that had been ruled for more than 30 years by Hosni Mubarak. Since then, Egypt's revolutionary spirit has been stifled. In 2013, a military coup established Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's government. Many regional political analysts and human rights activists say a climate of fear is left across the country. Said Sadiq, a professor of political sociology in Egypt, spoke with VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Ashanawi and offered some reasons for the failure of the Arab Spring in Egypt.
The first reason is that the famous slogan of the revolution, the people want to bring down the regime. Everybody agreed about that, that they want to get rid of the corrupt Mubarak regime. But they disagreed about what is the replacement. And that turned out to be the Achilles heel of this revolutionary coalition that led to toppling Mubarak. Secondly, you had foreign powers intervening. Our area is notorious for hosting long-serving dictators who also poured money into different forces to obstruct the process. Thirdly, you had the institutions remained in the hands of the Ancien regime of Mubarak, and they controlled all the networks, police, the judiciary, media, the army. So the revolutionary had nothing in their hands. Another factor was rush to early general and presidential election, when all political forces, the new political forces that emerged from the revolution, were not ready. And immediately after the revolution, the old deep state asked for quick elections, and that meant the old forces who are seasoned in election, like the Muslim Brotherhood and the old regime cronies, were able to take over the parliament and the presidential seat. Also, the images of failure and tragedies befalling other Arab Spring countries, Syria, Libya, Yemen, images of refugees suffering, gave the revolution a bad name, and also democratization. We just felt if democratization means that we will become refugees like the Syrians or be in chaos like in Yemen and Libya, we don't want it. There was no successful model from the Arab Spring emerging, even Tunisia. It has an ailing economy and endless paralyzing labor strikes. The image of revolutionaries in Egyptian media that was controlled by the counter-revolution distorted them. And so all these factors affected the transition and the support for revolution and support for democratization. People felt democratization may lead to Syria, another Iraq or Yemen or Libya. We don't want this.
With the military takeover after the second wave of uprising against the failure of Muslim Brotherhood after 1 year in power, did the Arab Spring in Egypt change the everlasting choice between the Islamists and the military?
Not at all. They still play this game. And the result is that you have this Al-Azhar and the army are controlling society. And this is the formula that has always existed. Now you are only excluding the Muslim Brotherhood, but not other Islamic groups like the Salafis, who are also supporting the regime. And people in Egypt just feel that the existing system is fine with them as long as we don't end up like our neighbors. And Sisi is playing the same old trick, mega project and stability, and that gives people hope that they are on the right track and that despite all political and media repression and economic hardship, at least we have a home. And so there is tolerance of what is happening, and they accept this kind of game. Every now and then there is criticism, but it doesn't reach the level of a third revolution because they feel that a revolution is not the way to make change, and they are accepting gradual transitional reform, not sudden eruption that can lead to a worse situation than they are living today.
But with the current constraints over freedom of expression and with poor performance of political parties, is there any hope for a democratic transition in Egypt in the near future?
Democratization is a long, historical, gradual, slow process. It takes time. And at least today, as a result of the revolution that took place in Egypt, it is no longer easy for the government to play with the constitution. And I think the rulers of Egypt today realize that they no longer can rule in the same way as in the past. And that is, by the way, an achievement.
That was Said Sadiq, a professor of political psychology in Egypt. He was speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Ashanawi. In Zimbabwe, the recent stay-away protest and demonstrations over a large fuel price increase have affected the entire country. Healthcare system, already teetering on the brink of collapse, has particularly been hard hit. Andy Kondo in Bulawayo has more on this story.
Because of the economic downturn in the country, Zimbabwe's health delivery system has in recent months been the source of much agony for Zimbabweans. Drugs have been scarce, and the country's medical doctors went on strike in December over pay and working conditions, amongst other things, bedeviling the sector. The strike ended with government commitment to address the medical doctors' concern over conditions within the country's hospitals, such as the shortage of drugs and other basic materials, such as surgical gloves. Last week's stay-away, which had been called for by the workers' representative body, the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions, only exacerbated the situation at the hospitals, with patients bearing the brunt of the protest action. Johannes Ndou, a nurse at one of the hospitals, speaks on his experiences during and after the stay-away.
Like, there are no drugs at government hospitals. When people go to government hospitals, they will be given prescriptions to go and source drugs, to buy drugs from pharmacies, but when they get to the pharmacies, pharmacies demand US dollars, but no one is getting those US dollars. I'm in contact with such scenarios, because you give someone prescription and you see those people be crying because they cannot afford. And at the end of the day, people do not blame the government. They blame the medical practitioners whom they're in contact with. But we as the medical practitioner, there's nothing we can do.
Another doctor said that the scarce medical resources in the hospitals has forced them to adopt drastic measures. Luke Moyo, a doctor at United Bulawayo Hospital, shares his thoughts on the state of health within the hospital.
So during the stay-away period in anesthesia, we suspended the elective list in anesthesia. Then we only concentrated on emergencies. Then as for now, the drugs are still scarce. the drugs have not yet been supplied from NATFARM. As the sundries as well are not yet available, they are in short supply. There is no gloves. And then the antibiotics are also in short supply. It means we now limit the number of people during the operation.
Okay.
If an operation needs about 8 people, we can now use about 4 people.
NATFARM is the state-owned drug manufacturer, and it is facing challenges in supplying the country's hospitals with much-needed drugs. The situation within the hospitals is so dire because the hospital dispensaries are still empty despite government assurances to supply drugs to pharmacies. Medical practitioners say that the only way to help the sick in hospitals is to give them a prescription.
And if they come without the medication, there's nothing we can do, just monitor. It's a challenge because even to discharge our services is difficult. It's like you are sitting there just monitoring someone without giving that person something that will help them to get better. We are just monitoring them without giving them the medication. The rate of deaths is increasing. It's increasing because people are not getting any treatment. So at the end of the day, you just nurse someone and that patient dies on the bed because of they can't afford medication.
When the stay away started, patients were left unattended.
We just left them there unattended. Some were discharged because senior doctors like consultants, they went and discharged those who were better. And those who couldn't be discharged, they were left there.
Meanwhile, press reports say that the Zimbabwean government imported US $5 million worth of tear gas canisters, truncheons and batons prior to the stairway. Observers say that many of the country's problems owe much to misplaced government priorities more than any other reason. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudanese refugees in Uganda get a helping hand. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is easier to solve, money problems or love problems, and why?
I think money, because for money maybe you can think of what to do and you get it, then you can get some money. But relationship, I don't think so.
According to me, I think I can solve love problems. But money, without money, right now, these days, even love is almost bought. You know, you should have money to please someone that you love.
As long as it is called a problem, you know, problems are very many in this world. And the only easy way to solve them, however much they can be, is to forgive.
To solve money problem, it's for someone to get a job, to be employed. Love problem, it's only one way that you can solve it, understanding each other.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese refugees in Uganda are welcoming a multi-billion dollar health program launched by the Ugandan government and aid agencies. The initiative will require the government and donors to spend at least $100 million a year from now until 2024 to buy medicine, build health facilities, and train health workers. Mungume Davis Rokarinch has more for VOA from Kampala, Uganda.
Speaking on behalf of South Sudanese refugees at the launch of the Health Sector Integrated Refugee Response Plan 2019-2024, refugee leader Susan Grace Duku says she believes the initiative will help improve services in refugee camps.
Sometimes refugees go to the health facilities and in return they are not given medicines. And for that reason, I felt that the health sector integrated response will strengthen the facilities in a way that medicines will be available for the patients to save their lives. When there is no medication, refugees resort into taking local herbs. So in that, it destroys their their health, and it brings future health problems.
Duku lives in Rhino Refugee Settlement in Uganda's northern district of Arua, having fled conflict in 2016 along with her four children and relatives. She says the lack of medical facilities in refugee camps and settlements affects mothers and infants in particular.
We have the problem of mortality, maternal health, where the referral pathway is not very clear. We lack ambulances. So in most time, you find that a mother dies before reaching the referral hospital on the way because of the delay in response to the referral.
Speaking at the initiative's launch in Kampala, Jonas Tegan Woldamariam, head of World Health Organization in Uganda, says the health campaign will address several health problems among refugees.
The launch of this integrated refugee response makes a step towards achieving another bigger goal, the health-related sustainable development goals of Uganda, including some of very ambitious, challenging, but attainable goals of SDG 3, including decreasing the under 5 mortality to less than 25 per thousand, decreasing neonatal mortalities to less than 12 per thousand live births, and decreasing maternal mortality rates to less than 70 per 100,000 live births by 2030.
The funds will be used to construct health facilities, procure medicines, and train and equip health personnel to work in refugee communities. Ugandan Prime Minister Ruhakana Rugunda says refugees play a key role in socioeconomic development of Uganda, but a large number of refugees strain already stretched resources of land, food, and water for residents and refugees. Nevertheless, Rugunda says Ugandan borders will remain open to help thousands of people fleeing conflict from neighboring countries, including South Sudan.
No one chooses to be a refugee, and as a people, we have our own painful experience where many of our people have, because of the turbulent history of our country, been forced to be refugees. We understand the critical importance of treating refugees humanely, decently, and with dignity. Today, it is them, and we are talking about them. Tomorrow, it could be any of us.
Uganda hosts more than a million refugees, mainly South Sudanese, who fled the country during the five-year-old conflict. For VOA News, Aya Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
From Uganda, we move to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where its official transfer of power took place today after chaos that preceded the presidential election. While Felix Tshisekedi has taken over as president from Joseph Kabila, the future still looks dim in a country wrecked by violence since its founding. And opposition leader Martin Fayulu, who claims he has been cheated out of victory, says he can't work with the new administration. My colleague Paul Alexander has talked with reporter Anastasi Tuzeshi in Kinshasa about the situation and how it could play out.
A director of cabinet has been appointed. His name is Vital Kamerhe, and he has been the campaign director of President Tshisekedi.
What implications does that carry?
Well, he's the director of cabinet, so he will, along with the president, he will choose the ministers.
Right. Are you surprised that it's not someone more directly related to Kabila?
No, I'm not surprised at all. And I think it's a very interesting and a very good pick because, first of all, Mr. Kamerhe knows the Kabila family, and he has been working with them for years. So he's not new to them. He's not a stranger to them. And I think that he would be it's a very strategic and very intelligent choice to me. And he also gained the confidence of President Tshisekedi. So I think he will be, he's the perfect media between the two teams.
So how does the future of politics look at this point?
It looks very blurred because nothing has transpired, not a word. So I would lie if I would tell you that it will go one way or the other. The only thing one can expect is about minerals, about, you know, the potentiality of Congo. And I think that the new team will work very hard on making sure that the Congolese people will get their share of the potentiality.
So given the country's political unrest in the past, does it seem likely that things will settle down now that there's a new president, or do you think that there's still the possibility of more violence?
Well, as we are speaking, three civilians have been killed in North Kivu. So I think that the new team will work very hard on this topic, because the president has mentioned that as soon as he was elected and yesterday again. So I think that the new team will work on that very, very adamantly, but that's all I can say. I am at Palais de la Nation, which is the presidential house, and I have assisted to, you know, the power handover between the two teams. It has been just like yesterday, very cordial, very, you know, smiling face, and very peaceful also. There is a feeling that they really want to work together, and that President Tshisekedi really wants, and he is, he mentioned it, he really wants to start working and make sure that the Congolese people are front and center of his actions.
Where does this leave Martin Fayulu?
So yesterday, during his speech, President Tshisekedi mentioned him and said, and even called him soldier of the people, and he saluted his fight. But I am not sure this will change anything in Mr. Fayulu's position. Last week, he told me while I was interviewing him that he had no intention to work with Mr. Tshisekedi because he considered himself the president-elect, and that these elections were rigged, and that there was no way he could work with such a team.
That was reporter Anastasie Tudeshi talking from Kinshasa with my colleague, Paul Alexander. That brings us to the end of our show for this Friday. We now leave you with Kang JJ singing in his native Nuer language. I wish I could translate the meaning of the song. Been listening to Kang JJ singing in Tuknaf, as they say it in Nuer. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We hope you have a safe and peaceful weekend. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.